episode of Work Like a Mother. My name's Amy, and this is my podcast all about working mums. Each week, I interview a different mother about what they do and how they do it, and get them to spill their secrets on having it all. This week, my guest is Frankie Thompson. She's a travel blogger, freelance writer, and self-published author who lives in Amsterdam with her family. And we chat about everything from how she became location independent and started her business as a writer, how she came to settle in Amsterdam and start her family there, all about the struggles that she had after her first son Otis is born, and all the ways in which she's preparing for her second baby, which is due very soon, which is very exciting. I really enjoyed this interview, and I'm pretty sure I now need to move to Amsterdam because it just sounds completely idyllic. So without further ado, here's my interview with Frankie. Hi Frankie, welcome to the podcast.
Hi Amy, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome, it's my pleasure. Would you like to give a little introduction for those who don't know who you are, about who you are and what you do?
Sure. I'm Frankie Thompson, and many hats, as many of your guests wear, I think. But I'm online mostly as The Bird Flies blog. I write a blog called As The Bird Flies, which is travel, mainly about travel and writing, but I also write quite a bit about motherhood now. My boy just turned 3 yesterday.
Oh, yay.
Yeah. So that's, I can't really deny that I write about that now, because it's been 3 years of writing about it. So they're my themes, but that brings in a little bit of money, but not really. So I pay the bills through freelance writing, and also as an author of fiction. So yeah, they're my three main things, I think.
Yeah, fab. Well, I'd like to kind of start way back before you were a mother, about kind of going traveling and how you end up settling, because you live in Amsterdam.
I do, yeah.
Yeah, I'd love to talk to a little bit about how you came to be there.
Sure. Really the long story is that I met an Australian guy when I was living in London, and my family were living in London, all my friends, my job and career. I worked in the city of London, so very corporate career. And I met this guy, and he was kind of the opposite. He had a location independent career and company that he was starting up at the time. And when I met him, he was a bit like, I've kind of got this plan to be nomadic, so I'm not really sure this is going to work out. And I was like, well, appreciate your honesty.
Yeah.
but I'm staying in London. So I kind of made him stay in London, I think, for 18 months. And in that time, he built up his business. I also did a little bit of, I started with freelance writing because I wasn't doing any kind of creative work or writing work at the time. But I started doing that on the side, and I'd also started a London-based blog. So I was getting into blogging and really enjoying that. And then we just jacked in our jobs, this sort of cliche story, sold all our stuff. And we left, I think, October 2011. And we were nomadic for the best part of 2 years. And we did a lot of slow travel. We stayed in places for 2 to 3 months sometimes, sometimes just a few weeks or days, but mostly we did big stints so that we could do work, essentially. I was writing my books then as well. That always needed quite a bit of time. But so then we ended up in Amsterdam for a house sit as part of that kind of nomadic experience. It was in the summer of 2013. Beg your pardon, 2012, and we just fell in love with the city, but we'd already made plans to move on afterwards, and also the people who were living there wanted their house back.
so inconvenient of them.
I know. So we actually went on and did another year of travel, and just nowhere really compared, which was kind of telling. And also just we'd already started to talk about the future and having kids, so we made plans to return for 6 months in 2013, and we're still here.
Amazing.
With one kid and one on the way.
Yeah. So, had you been to Amsterdam before, or was that the first time you'd been when you were house sitting?
I'd been before. I'd done all the horrible touristy red light district things. I'd done the ferry across. I went to university in Hull, so I took the ferry across with a merry group of people about age 19, and that was a messy weekend. So I really, when my partner suggested Amsterdam as a place to live, I was a bit like, oh, right, wait a minute, you're just going to get stoned for 3 months, aren't you? Actually, we lived in sort of what's called like the old suburbs of Amsterdam, which is outside the main ring canals. And it was a completely kind of eye-opening lifestyle change insofar as, well, now it's summer here as well, people don't really work very much. And there's a really nice work-life balance with not just if you've got a family, but also just if you're, you know, young, free and single. And it's just a nice city to be in. He's from Sydney, I'm from London. We're both city people, but we were also looking for something a bit smaller and, yeah, cheaper. So, yeah, it just really worked for us. And now we like people to come over and we like to show them that side of the city, and they kind of can't quite believe that they never left the red light district.
Yeah,
before.
No, definitely. I'm sure you're aware of the book, The Happiest Kids in the World.
Yes.
About sort of Dutch children. And I'd love to chat about, like, if you'd noticed anything sort of different about raising. I know you didn't have a kid when you lived in London, but you obviously were a child in the UK. So whether you sort of noticed any differences or what you kind of thought about that.
Yeah, no, it's really, I think it's really interesting, and I think it's also a really, I think it's valid. I don't think the happiest makes such a bold statement, doesn't it? And I think kids are happy everywhere. But I definitely see things that I like, and I certainly am drawn to as a mother now. So there's not much focus on like homework at a young age. Certainly there's a lot less pressure, and some of my British or non-Dutch friends kind of moan about how much playing kids do at school. Montessori is a huge thing here. I would say the vast majority of primary schools are Montessori based, or Dalton, which is a similar ethos to education. And there's not much helicopter parenting here. You hardly ever see kind of when kids go up and climb up on a on a fort or whatever, or in a climbing frame, the mums are sitting on the bench having coffee and chatting. And it's just that kind of mentality that I'm quite drawn to. It's also just a very safe city. And because of the cycling, there's lots of open space, public space, parks, things like that. And kids have a lot of independence with the cycling. So my son's already, you know, running around on his balance bike on his own. And obviously not always. Sometimes he decides he's had enough and I have to carry him and the bike.
Oh, gosh. But,
it feels very easygoing, I guess, is the right kind of word to use.
Yeah, that's very appealing, I think, because I think a lot of people feel, especially in the UK, like a lot of pressure around parenting, like, are you doing it right? Read all these books, you know, if you don't raise them right from the day dot, they're not going to be, you know, happy, successful, well-rounded people. And that kind of more laid-back approach, I definitely appreciate, especially now I am a mum.
Yeah, I think it's that academic pressure that I certainly can remember as a kid. And I think it's kind of sad that spills into kids that are so young. I don't know what it's like at secondary school here. I'll be able to tell you in about 10 years time, but I definitely feel like, kids are here to learn through doing rather than sitting and watching or being taught, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, definitely. No, it sounds idyllic. I'll be on the, whatever the Dutch version of Rightmove is, very shortly.
Thunder, it's called.
Nice. How's it been being away from, because it's just you and your other half, you don't have any family in Amsterdam?
Yeah, that's definitely the hardest part for me personally. I'm close to my family. They all live within 1 hour of each other in the South England, south of London. So I do find that hard. And obviously from a practical perspective, just childcare and just, you know, having someone to pick up the slack, we have less options. Fewer options rather, but it does make the time that I spend with my family, be it here or back at home, back in the UK, it does make it very special. And now my son is really, you know, very close to my grandparent, his grandparents, my parents, and but I quite like the fact that he already has quite worldly wise, in terms of he has grandparents in one country and actually grandparents in another country as well, and cousins in a different one to that. So it's I think there are, you know, positives and negatives, but certainly when things are hard, like when I was quite poorly after my son's birth, and also now I'm pregnant again, and it's just, you know, it's a little bit, now I've got a toddler, that it's certainly more tiring than being pregnant the first time. You do sort of have these moments where I just want to pick up the phone to my mum and say, can I just come round?
Yeah, or come over and look after him while I have a little nap or whatever.
Yeah, definitely. Stuff like that. But we have a good army of Dutch babysitters, and you know, we've got a good network now, which I definitely didn't have before. Well, certainly that took a good 6 months to a year to build up. So that counts for a lot.
Yeah, no, definitely. And it's not that far. I mean, it is far enough that you can't pop over for a cup of tea, but no. the flight between the UK and Amsterdam isn't too bad or too expensive either, which I guess is maybe harder for your partner if his family's in Australia.
Well, yeah, his family are even more complicated. His mum's actually married to an Icelandic man. Oh. So they live in Iceland.
Oh my gosh, amazing. I love Iceland.
Yeah, but not at the moment, because they're just not having a summer at all. We're sucking up all the heat. But yeah, and they really need it, bless them. But so they're there, which is lovely for visits, but unfortunately doesn't really happen very often. And then his brother is back in Australia. So the flight, that's a completely different ball game when it comes to seeing them. Though we love Thailand. We lived in Thailand when we were nomadic. So we have actually done, I think, two holidays where we've met in the middle in Thailand.
Oh, that's nice.
Which is, yeah, really lovely.
Two birds, one stone, as it were.
Yeah, exactly.
And obviously are you still both location independent? Would you see yourself moving somewhere else, or do you think, no, Amsterdam is it for now?
I don't think like a permanent move. I think we would maybe consider doing, like, because Otis has got another year now before he starts school, we would maybe consider doing like 3 or 4 months, funnily enough, in Thailand or somewhere like that. Just to kind of, because we can, we're really lucky. But I'm not making any decisions like that until number two is here.
No, definitely. Yeah.
But there's no, even in the UK, sadly, like when I was sort of wanting to, I have moments where I want to be closer to my family, but there's nowhere in the UK that really offers us what we have here and what we value here. So that's quite, it's quite hard. There's nowhere else. So I guess if it ain't broke.
Yeah, no, definitely. It sounds pretty idyllic. Obviously, everyone has its problems, but it sounds like it's working for you guys. So obviously this podcast is called Work Like a Mother, so we should probably talk about work rather than my dreams of moving to Amsterdam now. So you kind of have a bit of a dreamy job. I think a lot of people would think that being a freelance writer and author is pretty cool. Could you talk a little bit about kind of how you came to do what you do? Obviously you were working in a corporate job originally and then looking for something creative.
Yeah, sure. Well, I guess my corporate work actually is relevant. I kind of don't talk about it very much for good reason, but I think I will now because it's actually quite interesting and it does actually lead into what I did. So I did languages at university, which has got nothing to do with the price of cheese, but I then went on to do research, multilingual research for a couple of companies that are effectively kind of corporate intelligence. So they do investigation work in the corporate sector. So that's like checking out companies before mergers, checking out high-powered execs before they're hired, headhunting, sort of research, kind of that level of work. And I also did it in-house at Microsoft, which was a bit more kind of like employee theft issues and stuff like that, security, corporate security. So I did a lot of investigation work for the best part of, I think, 10 years in the end. When did I graduate? No, sorry, 6 or 7 years. And I also worked briefly at the City of London Police. So that was a really interesting experience, doing similar kind of thing, but obviously, for actual, genuine, real crime.
Yeah, you're like a low-level spy.
Yeah, something like that. They didn't give me a uniform, so no.
Oh,
But I'd always wanted to do something more creative. And actually, my mum always said to me, I never expected you to do work like this. I always thought you'd go into something like in the arts, basically. So it was always on my mind. And then when I started blogging, I just wanted an outlet because I wanted to just try writing, see if I enjoyed it, see if people read it, see if I, you know, if this was something that I did want to maybe one day think about doing. So I started writing a blog about Shepherd's Bush in London, which is a West London borough, which has completely changed actually in the last 10 years. I wouldn't recognise it now, but when I lived there, it was quite a dirty kind of, I loved it. It was very sort of a challenging area to live in. Yeah, it had, yeah, gritty is the word, urban. It had lots of different conflicts and different issues, but also it had a lot going for it and a lot of positivity. Now it's really gentrified, I think. But at the time, it was a lot of fun to write about the area, and I met a lot of people, and I kind of learned a lot about social media and blogging and content. And that was when the same sort of time I met my partner, and he said, well, he's a web developer and he builds websites and programs. So he said, oh, why don't you just start doing some writing work for me and some of my kind of colleagues' companies. And he worked for some agencies as well. So I did a little bit for a couple of agencies. And so that's really how I kind of dipped my toes in. And then it seemed like a viable way to make money. But then when I left London to go traveling, I started up a new blog, which is the As the Bird Flies one, because I wanted to be, I was bird in the bush, so now I'm As the Bird Flies, if you see what.
Nice, yeah. I see what you did there.
Yeah, thank you. So now I was writing a lot more about travel, and I was really lucky at the time. Travel blogging was relatively still quite small, so I got a lot of opportunities with brands, and I built up a portfolio, and then was able to get work through word of mouth after maybe about 2 years. So, and now it's a bit different because I work only really part-time, and I'm with my son for sort of, well, 1 or 2 days a week depending on the week. And so I only really have 2 or 3 main clients that kind of I'm on a retainer with, and I do their everything from big project work through to managing their social media and newsletters and any kind of comms. So I think that's kind of the long and short of how I got into it. But the fiction is the thing that I want to be doing full time. So I still feel like I'm a work in progress. So it's very lovely to hear I have a dream job, because for me, it's not a nightmare job, not at all. I'm very lucky to do what I do. But I'm constantly trying to tweak it and trying to make it so I can do more writing of books and less of the content writing, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. And you self-publish your books.
I do.
Yeah. Can you talk a bit about that process? Because I'm sure quite a lot of people would be interested in how that works.
Yeah. I think it was something that I... it's tricky because I'm actually now I've had some chats with some writer friends and soul searching in this last 6 months, and I may try to get a deal soonish.
More like traditional publishing.
Yeah. So yeah, because I feel like I need to try it, because I keep talking about how self-publishing works for me, but I'll be totally honest and say, well, I haven't tried the alternative, so how do I really know? So I'm just wondering that I've kind of. Worrying that I'm BSing myself, basically,
yeah.
Trying to convince myself, because for me, the whole process of traditional publishing, it speaks to so many of my demons, let's just say. So like the whole issue of rejection, the sort of giving up of creative control, the having to work to other people's deadlines, which yes, I can do for my kind of freelance writing, but with my fiction, I've always just taken my time and fitted it in around everything else. So that's quite scary for me.
And also with like content writing, like it's very rare that you'd be writing anywhere near the number of words that you would for a book.
No, thank goodness.
So you can just say, oh, if I need that by the end of the week, that's fine. It's 500 words, that, you know, a couple of hours, don't, you know, I'll find time. But yeah, a full book is another ball game, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think it's also the whole thing is a little bit like, it's just it makes me very vulnerable. It makes me, you know, have to kind of do things I don't want to do necessarily and hear things I don't want to hear. You know, I work with editors already, but I remember what that was like at the beginning. It's just terrifying and in many ways soul destroying, having something that you pour so much of yourself into. And it's so incredibly personal, writing fiction, or at least it is for me. And then just to have somebody kind of, you know, not tear it apart, that's never actually happened to me, but just to kind of, you know, have to really, they have to go through it with a fine tooth comb and they have to find the stuff that's not working in order for it to be the best it is. So for somebody to do that, even though it's the same process and ultimately the same kind of is happening the same way, but the idea of somebody in a stuffy office in London in a suit doing it just scares me a bit more than somebody just doing it in their pajamas at home like I do.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's kind of it's a trade-off between the two, isn't it? Obviously you get to keep that control and stuff, and less sort of vulnerable if you're self-publishing, but obviously traditional publishing opens doors of all their resources, like marketing budgets. And not having to do it all yourself, which I'm sure has definitely got an appeal. What's the actual process of self-publishing? Do you have your books printed?
It's changed ever so much. When I first started, it was really only Amazon was the only way to do it, and that was through ebooks. And then also they have a subsidiary called CreateSpace where you can do publishing on demand. So that's basically you kind of get a book ready, and when somebody orders the paperback on Amazon or on other platforms now, it prints the book as and when they
ask
for
it. Right, okay, so you don't need to have like a stack of 500 in your office.
No, I actually do have some, because I'm hoping to have a little shop on my blog just for people who want like personal message and kind of wrapped up with a postcard from Amsterdam. So I will be selling direct, because I've seen a few other indie authors do that quite successfully, and I think it's a really nice touch. But yeah, so that's how the paperback works, and the ebook is very, very easy now. There are so many programs out there where you just upload a Word document and it just basically transforms it into the right format for Kindles or other e-readers, or also just a PDF so anybody can read it on a tablet or iPad. It's a very similar process from the traditional publishing, in that I work with an editor, I then work with possibly a copy editor and then a proofreader. So there's multiple different people.
And do you employ them yourself? So they're like freelancers as well?
They're freelance, yes. I pay them as and when. It's quite a big outlay on books. And because I'm really keen on quality, I don't cut any corners with any of that, which again makes it quite a long process. So before I had my son, a book would take me, maybe a 50,000-60,000 word book would take me about a year to write and publish, and now it's completely slowed down to nearly 2 or 3 years. So it's a labor of love for sure, but they are my proudest work achievements, I have to say. So it is worth it. And but you have to enjoy the journey with writing. I think it's with so many things, you can't really go into it only wanting the book. You have to want the journey and the processes and the learning and the lessons that you kind of gain from it. That's where the real value, I think, just creatively, but also on a personal level, that's where the value is.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's not like you say, it's a slow process, so you can't be too impatient about it, can you? So do you have any sort of tips and tricks for people who maybe like to try self-publishing themselves?
Yeah, sure. So if you've already written lots of stuff and you know what you're doing on that side of things, I would just really think about what you want to achieve through publishing a book before you make a decision whether you do traditional or indie. Because if it is just I want, you know, something of me to last after I'm gone, or I want to give this to my readers, or you've already got a platform and a readership, then I would, and you want complete creative control over it, then indie author is probably the right route for you. And there are hybrids as well. So there's like, you can do a crowdfunding, you can use Kickstarter, but there's also Unbound, which is a publishing platform where basically people buy your book before it's published. So that gives you the capital to actually go ahead and publish it. But that for me, I have a friend who's doing it at the moment, Amy Lord. 10 Penny Dreams is her blog, and I mean, it's just she's doing incredible. I think she's like 80% of the way there, but she's really had to work for it.
I mean, crowdfunding is a big commitment in terms of, like, it's not just put it on there and then people just are looking around going, oh yeah, I'll donate to that. It is definitely, it's like a huge marketing sort of undertaking, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. So that's sort of But if you want to make, you know, you want to be the next J.K. Rowling or Stephen King, and you want to make a gazillion pounds, well, firstly, I'd say lower your expectations. Yeah. And then I'd say, yeah, you really ideally want an agent who can then get the right publisher for you and your books. So because of indie publishing and self-publishing, traditional publishing is becoming more flexible. So you do get writers now that write in multiple genres, whereas before, and still sometimes now, but they kind of lock you in. You're a chick lit author, you only write chick lit, but that is evolving now. So
people used to have pseudonyms, didn't they, if they were doing a different,
that's right, if you've got the writing kind of nailed. But if like you're like me, maybe six or seven years ago, and you're just, I just want to write a book, I feel like this is something I want to do creatively, then I would just start writing now, whatever it is. I don't think you learn how to write other than by writing. It's just one of those things. And also by making mistakes and by writing thousands and thousands of words that will never, ever be read. Thank goodness. So, and I'm actually starting, I'm writing my first, I've written several drafts of novels, but I've never really written one that I believe in enough to publish. So I've been working on an idea for the last year and a bit, just kind of the planning stages. And I'm now starting, hopefully soon I'll start writing a first draft and have that finished before the baby comes, and then pick it up again sometime next year. So I'm actually documenting that process on my blog, just in a series of posts called How to Write a Book. So it's really, I guess, mainly for fiction, but hopefully there's also parts of it that's relevant for nonfiction too. So if anyone's interested in that, they can also come along on that journey with me.
Yeah, definitely. That sounds really interesting. So how many books have you published so far?
I've published 3 short story collections, and a novella, and then about 10 other short stories separately, just as little singles, they're called, on Kindle on Amazon. And I'm publishing my first book of poetry, hopefully in the next few months.
Ooh. Amazing.
So, and then hopefully also this novel next year. That would be really, really cool.
That would be really, it definitely would be cool. Well, fingers crossed.
Yeah,
fingers crossed for it. So you kind of mentioned that it used to sort of take you a year, and now after your son was born, it's taking a lot longer. I don't know if you could maybe just speak a little bit about how things changed for you work-wise once your son was born, because obviously being freelance, you know, there's not like this dedicated maternity leave period in the same way as if you have sort of a more corporate job.
Yeah. So I had a kind of very surprising experience after my son was born, in that I was kind of gagging to get back to work.
I don't know whether it's just who I picked to be on this podcast, but I feel like a lot of people are like, yeah, no, I was desperate to get back to work.
Oh, good. Okay. You. I expected to take 4 months off, and we budgeted for that, and and actually in the Netherlands you get maternity benefit, effectively it's called pregnant and self-employed, and you get a certain percentage of your income every month, I think, for 4 or 5 months. So that was very lovely, thank you Dutch government. But I by about 4 or 5 weeks I actually had a job come in from Expedia, and they were like, oh, I'm just emailing you this on the off chance. And I was like, I'll do it. And it was hard. It was really, really hard work to do. My son didn't really sleep properly for 14, 15 months. So we had awful sleep deprivation, all of us. For a long time. And so that was very, very hard. But getting back to work was so important to me, because I kind of felt like my identity got swallowed in becoming a mum, and that was also partly because I had postnatal anxiety and depression, and I just lost so many pieces of myself, from my sense of humour through to my feeling of confidence as a writer and as a professionally as well as the fiction writing. It was very important to me to go back to work, and I'm glad I did, but I also probably shouldn't have gone back so full of gusto. I should have also taken time to allow for the fact I wasn't sleeping, and I also was depressed, and so it was it took me a long time to find any kind of balance. And I think most of the mums on your podcast would say there is no balance, you know, that's a myth, and it's really just about finding what works for you, and that doesn't work always work for you, not every week, not every day. So yeah, I definitely struggled, and I feel like I'm going to do a lot of things differently, but I probably will still also go back to work fairly quickly, because I like it. I know it's important to me for my mental health. And my son started daycare 3.5 months, which does seem quite early now when I think about it. But we think it's been the best thing for him. He's so sociable and confident, and also for his Dutch, because we only speak English at home. So I think for us, it did work, him going to daycare. And also because we don't have family at home again. So there is no, oh, can you just take him for an afternoon so I can get some emails done? No, I can't really do that. So yeah, so I will probably do the same sort of thing, but maybe a little bit later, and just I'll start slower with the work myself this time around.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, I didn't go back to work really until started doing one day a week about 6 months, my actual job. Gosh. But I was like blogging like the next day. I was like, I need to do something. Yeah. And also like it is, you are really tired and you do have a lot on, but at the same time, you're like, they can't really engage with you. So you are, a lot of it is very boring. Like a lot of it is just kind of sat there, really? Like, you know, being boring. Used as a human pillow for a long time, which doesn't leave your brain to do things. So I'm not surprised that people are like, oh my God, especially after so long in your adult life, you know, assuming that you've had, you know, 10 years or whatever of a career, or of just of work, even if you don't call it a career, to suddenly be like nothing for weeks and weeks on end. Is there such a change? That it doesn't surprise me that people are doing things. So what does a sort of a typical week, I know there's no such thing as typical, I always say that when I ask the question, because I feel like that's such a loaded term, but what does that sort of look like for you, and how many days are your son currently in daycare and stuff?
Yeah, so he's in daycare Monday, Tuesday, Wednesdays, and so I have an office in a WeWork co-working space in Amsterdam, so I go there most of those days. I also try to do exercise and a couple of me things, like get my nails done or just go for a walk or go to a museum. I try to do at least one thing like that for me in one of those days. And then Thursday, Friday, he's at preschool in the morning just until, about 1 o'clock. And so then I'm with him in the afternoons. I don't know what it is, but it feels like the last 6 weeks, there's always been like a public holiday or something. Yeah. So every week hasn't really been the same, and we've been on holiday and stuff like that. So this is the first week actually where it's been relatively normal, but then it's been his birthday, so it hasn't. So yeah. They keep you on your toes, don't they?
Definitely. And so what you sort of mentioned, what you're kind of thinking about doing for sort of new baby coming along, is there anything else that you're sort of doing to prepare to kind of have a bit of a different experience?
Therapy?
Yeah. Very wise. That is a very wise decision. Yeah, definitely. Because obviously it'll be different with two the second time around. And obviously no one can know what that's like until it happens to you. But
no. I'm just hoping it won't be as much of a shock. I know it sounds ridiculous when you're pregnant I was pregnant for over 9 months, and I'd wanted to have babies all my life. And this kid was so, so wanted and so, so loved, but it was just such a shock to me becoming a mum. And I'm just hoping that won't be quite so much of a shock.
Yeah.
And
you
I'm
have
just...
some prior knowledge this time.
Exactly. I'm just going to rest more. We left the hospital after 4 hours after he was born. I just thought I was superwoman because I'd survived labour and given birth to a 9-pound baby. But but really, I could have done with, you know, just taking it a lot easier. So I'll, in the immediate few weeks, I will be doing a lot more rest and just focusing on the new baby and my family. And we're doing the whole pulling up the drawbridge thing. We had family from the UK and Australia last time in the first 2 weeks. That's not happening this time, unless they can look after my other one.
and stay at a hotel or something rather than actually under your roof.
And so that will be very different. And then just in terms of work, I'm going to be very selective. I'm very lucky that I have really good clients that I've worked closely with now for 2 or 3 years. So I think that won't be too much of a problem. And if I'm not good, then I will I will 100% say that, and I won't have any shame in delaying when I go back to work. But yeah, I joked, but I am doing a lot of therapy right now to prepare, and I'm also hiring a doula, which I didn't have last time. So that's quite interesting and exciting. And I like her because at the first meeting she said, "I won't do all that hippie shit unless you want me to."
That is my kind of doula.
So just things like that. And also this is the last, all being well, this is the last time we'll do this. So part of me wants to do it right because I did it so wrong the first time, which is a terrible attitude to have for childbearing. But really that I do just feel like I want to, if at all possible, through the sleep deprivation and aching body parts, I would just really like to enjoy it a bit more.
No, definitely. Well, you sound like you're setting yourself up really well for it as far as you can. I hope so. Obviously, there's always surprises. Yeah. And also, you often don't get two bad sleepers. I mean, I don't know if that's the case. I don't want to jinx things. I'm literally touching all the wood on my desk right now for you. But like, because we had quite a, our son, not to boast, was a fairly good sleeper. He's not so much at about 10 to 12 months, but the first few months he was fairly good. So we weren't as sleep deprived as I think some people are. But then everyone goes, well, you're not going to have that second. You know, we might not have a second baby, but you're not going to get that the second time. So maybe it'll be the opposite way around for you. If you had a bad sleeper the first time, you'll get a good sleeper this time.
I hope
you'll
so.
You'll feel bright and all will be well.
Yeah, I mean, that for me is a dream. But because it was so, so bad, I can't even like entertain that delicious thought. I have to just, I'm like totally preparing for survival mode.
Batting down the hatches. Yeah.
Absolutely. And if that's what it is, then that's fine. And like I said, I will just ask for help more. And we have babysitters. We're quite lucky that we can afford, if we have to, we could afford somebody to also maybe stay over a night a week or every 2 weeks just to give us a break. I'm just not ashamed this time to say, hey, this is bloody hard. Because I look back on it now and I think, how did I do it? Actually, how did I do it? How did I get like 4 or 5 hours sleep for, you know, 10 months, you know, without break, and then also do my work? I just don't know how I did it.
I mean, so. It sounds incredibly impressive. not ideal, but impressive.
It's amazing how being stubborn and too proud, how far that can get you until you then crash and burn, unfortunately. Yeah. So, yeah.
And I think also part of it is maybe, like I felt this a little bit, even though I definitely didn't have it half as hard, is like, you're already aware of that you're a mum. Mm. Like, and obviously you're more aware of that than anyone else, but like, you don't want to then be like asking for even more kind of grace from other people, cause, no. Like in the workspace. Cause you're like, you're already like aware that maybe mums are looked down on a little bit.
Oh, absolutely.
And thought of as, oh, well, they're just going to leave as soon as the kid's sick or whatever. And I'd say that knowing that my company actually isn't like that at all and everyone's been wonderful, but you kind of feel very self-conscious about it. And you're like, you don't want to like make it even worse by being like, actually, no, this is even harder and I can't do it. And like confirm the stereotype almost.
No, absolutely. And it's almost impossible not to compare yourself to other mums these days, be it on social media or in the workplace or just in your social circles. Like, everybody has such a different journey. And, you know, I had friends with unicorn babies who were sleeping through from 4 weeks forever.
I mean, I know it sounds wonderful, but also I think I wouldn't have got any sleep because I'd have been waking up constantly like, oh my God, you're dead. Oh my God, he's definitely dead. Yeah. Oh my God.
Yeah. But I mean, and they just couldn't understand our struggle, you know. But then having said that, they've had difficult 2-year-olds, and our boy was kind of cool as a 2-year-old, and our boy gave up the dummy by himself at 10 months, things like that. So it definitely is swings and roundabouts. But in terms of, I think, asking for help, I think we are just so kind of trained to be, okay, well, if somebody else is doing okay, then I have to do okay. But you don't know like what your journey is like for you, relatively speaking. Like, you, for me, I look back on it now and I knew I was susceptible to depression. I had so many kind of contributing factors in terms of living away from family. And, you know, just, I don't know why I beat myself up for getting sick. And again, it's getting sick. You don't do mental health to yourself, like mental health problems to yourself. There's something in your brain. And
sleep deprivation is a massive trigger for mental
Absolutely.
Health.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a reason they do it as torture, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. So we kind of touched on this a little bit before, but I believe, as everyone who's listened to this podcast before will know, that you can have it all, but not all at once. So I just wondered if you could maybe share something that you're sort of letting go at the moment in order to kind of keep the other things afloat, as it were.
Yeah, I always like this part of your podcast because it's like, yeah, we need to talk more about what we don't do as and that being a good thing.
Yeah.
So for me, it's definitely and this took a long time as well, but I'm letting go of some of the kind of writing goals that I had for myself and have for myself still. So I'm being a bit kinder and patient with myself with that, because also my kids will only be little for so long. And I want to enjoy that. I'm very lucky that I get to be with them for a huge part of it. And I'm also forgiving myself for having difficulties and struggles, no matter how big or small. And I'm teaching myself. I won't say I'm there yet, but I'm teaching myself that looking after myself, both proactively but also reactively, should the worst happen again, that is the most important thing, not just to me, but for my family, and also in a roundabout way, my work and my clients.
Yeah, definitely. It all comes, it's all that, you can't pour from an empty cup and all of those, all those cliches, which are actually incredibly true. definitely. That is an excellent answer. So what about on the days that things do go a little bit wrong, or, I say days, months, potentially, what are your kind of strategies for dealing with that?
Netflix.
Yeah.
For the kids? No. That's a good question. And actually, I've been trying to catch myself in that kind of overwhelmed, panicked feeling. And I recently wrote a list of free self-care acts that you can do. And some of them are like for when you feel overwhelmed, because I recently, my Otis had chicken pox and we just got back from holiday. So I was totally swamped with work. But I had to take another week off to look after him. And he was really a rat bag, I have to be honest, during this whole episode. And I was on empty, and pregnant as well. So that doesn't help. And so I was trying to just mentally almost stop myself from falling into that, that downward spiral of negativity. And that's really, 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 really hard. And so I think for me, it is forgiving myself when it happens, but also trying to do things. So like I have to kind of go into myself. So whether that's taking time away just to sit by myself or lie by myself, and I will cancel social engagements, things like that, because I'm just not ready to see people when I feel overwhelmed or anxious. But just in terms of like a general bad day, I try and do something silly. I try to get in the bath with Otis and blow bubbles around and make a big mess. Or I try to like do some dancing with him. He's quite into that now. Or I remember, certainly not at the moment because it's the peak of summer, but earlier in the year, there was one day where we were just climbing the walls and nothing, he just wasn't interested in anything I was trying to do, and I couldn't get anything done around the house. And it was raining, but I just went out for a walk with him anyway. And we just walked down the street in the rain and laughed and splashed in puddles. And it kind of just broke, it kind of reset the day. This makes me sound like I'm like the most amazing creative mum in the world. This is not, this is what I aim for rather than what I do religiously.
Yeah, no, definitely. I do think I've noticed like since the summer months, like being able to just go outside so much more frequently. Obviously my son's only just turned one, and he, when he was very small, I was like, I don't want to just go out in the rain because he's just lying underneath a plastic sheet and I'm just getting soaked. It's not really helping us in any way. Whereas I think now he's a bit bigger, he's just taken a few first steps. So I'm hoping by the time I'm hoping by the time winter actually rolls around, he'll be able to walk properly and we can do stuff like splashing the puddles if we have to. If we're like, oh my God, I just need to leave this house. I just need to leave this house. Like, it'll be a bit more productive to actually go outside sometimes. And do those things, and it's fun when you're a kid to get, because it's you're not supposed to go out when it's raining. No. So it's a bit like subversive to like go outside in that, be allowed to.
Yeah, they just love it, and just dirt and just anything like that. I mean, I'm a clean freak, so I have to really bite my lip and just let him do it. But yeah, they just you don't need fancy things or grand plans. They just need to kind of change the scenery semi regularly. And I think I do too. I think if I'm like, when I have desk days, I'm fried by the end of it and generally not my best version of myself. So I also try to get out and walk every day as well.
And I think also you maybe forget a little bit about it when you're on maternity leave or like when you first have a baby, because when you're sort of, when I was working 9 to 5, I'd go out of the house every single day because I had to go to work. Whereas sometimes when I was on maternity leave and I had a baby, I was like, oh, I haven't left the house in 3 days. You just kind of forget that the outside world exists a little bit. So it's good to have like a little reminder to just be like, no, just go outside, get out, and it will all be okay, in theory anyway. And last but certainly not least, are there any other mums that you find really interesting or inspiring that you think other people should know about and follow along with?
Well, I think we have a mutual crush on Elise Joy.
Yes,
is that
we do.
Right?
Yeah, yes, yeah. We do, definitely.
I love her. She's amazing. She is. I mean, I think she's a completely different personality type to me, because just her sheer consistent level of productivity is just, it blows my mind.
It's more inspiring, isn't it?
Yeah. But I tell myself, well, she's got girls and girls are easy, which is a terrible thing to say to anybody. And like, I'm trying to like joke that off there.
Grasping at straws as to why we're not doing quite so many things. Yeah.
No. I generally do like people who are mega productive. I also quite like some of the UK big names in mummy blogging. Mother Pucker, I think, is bloody awesome for what she does. And mainly the thing I like about her is that she owns up to her mistakes and she publicly learns from them. And I think that's you don't see that enough on social media. I also really like, she's not really mummy at all, but Sarah Tasker from Me and Orla. I like the way she, in her podcast recently with Jen Carrington, has been really fab for me, because they kind of really talk about owning not your limitations, but just owning your situation. And like, so they both have chronic illnesses and actually kind of not apologizing for it, not kind of working around it, but working with it. And I think if we all did that again, that's like Mother Pucker, who champions the flex appeal, flexible working. I think if we all just did that, we'd come up against so little resistance and obstacles and challenges from other people and from ourselves. And so I generally like people who are very honest and very positive. I guess they're the two things I try to do myself. Lucy Lucraft as well, what she said, she's the same. I like her little stories with Anais when she's crying and she's like, you know, this is birth control.
Yeah.
I do the same thing with Otis. So I think that's a good group of people.
Those are a great list. Yeah, like a little dream dinner party there. Yeah. We'll get it together. Amazing. And would you like to share where people can find you as well?
Yeah, so I'm on Instagram as the Birdflies blog. Twitter as the bird flies and Facebook as well, and as the bird flies blog.com is my blog. And I actually haven't mentioned them at all, but if you are a writer or you like writing, I also create affirmation cards for writers. They're called Write Now Cards, all one word, on Instagram, and they're daily affirmation statements to help you build and enjoy your writing practice more, whatever that is, blog, professional, writing books, just writing in a journal. I believe so strongly that writing can bring a hell of a lot of joy and satisfaction to your life. So I like to help other people write. So that's Write Now Cards. You can also find me there.
Amazing. Well, thanks so much for chatting with me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And that's all, folks. As always, you can find the show notes for this episode at amyliz.co.uk/podcast. And this is usually where I ask you to rate and review the podcast on your podcast app of choice. And obviously, I would still love for you to do that. That would be absolutely dreamy. But what I would love even more than that is if you know a mum who might benefit from this podcast, from hearing women speak about the struggles they have, about how they make things work for them, then I would just really love you to point them in this direction. That would be super helpful for me and hopefully for them as well. So Yeah, spread the love, my friend. Spread the love. For this podcast and all podcasts, if you like a podcast, then tell me about it because I love podcasts. I can't get enough of them. Hence why I have two already. As always, you can also find me on Twitter and Instagram at Amy Liz Blog, AmyLizBlog. If you want to chat about anything from this episode or anything at all, really, I'm always happy to chat. And yeah, next week, my guest is Nicola Ray Wickham. She is a coach and a former people pleaser who kind of got over her fears and started living her dream life, which is brilliant. So I am really excited to chat to her and share what she had to say with you. Until then, we'll speak soon. Bye-bye.